Nothing is so terrible as a pretentious movie. I mean, a movie that aspires for something really terrific and doesn't pull it off is shit, it's scum.
Welcome to The Art of Story. This season we'll be doing a 7-part in-depth analysis of the Francis Ford Coppola 1979 film Apocalypse Now. This is Apocalypse Now Decoded. Written, produced, and narrated by Adam Argo, a Cinematic Gore production. This series is a deep dive analysis of Apocalypse Now, using the principles presented in my book, The Story Ritual, Character Arcs and Rites of Passage, an illustrated guide into the subconscious. Each episode will explore the dramatic structure of the script, break down the acts, scenes, subtext, and plot points, track the psychological journey of the protagonist, and come to a greater understanding of the character arc. The Story Ritual is available in print, PDF, and audiobook at cinematicgore.com.
Please like, follow, rate, and review at Spotify and YouTube. Episode 1, The Butcher and the Chef.
This series will be a deep dive analysis of Apocalypse Now using principles presented in my book, The Story Ritual, Character Arcs and Rites of Passage. My thesis of the story ritual is that the modern term character arc is actually describing the ancient practice of the transformation of values through rituals called rites of passage. I'll use the tools presented in my book to decode the layered meanings of the film and evaluate the way Apocalypse Now initiates the audience through the ritual of story. The story ritual is available in print, PDF, and audiobook at cinematicgore.com. I wrote the book to be a concise visual handbook for storytellers to reference as they develop their own stories. It's loaded with illustrations and diagrams intended to present these principles in a clear, concentrated, specific manner. I wanted it to be a kind of textbook with straightforward terms and definitions for easily accessible reference. Because of this, I didn't want to bog down the text with examples. I carved away as much fat as I could and boiled the concepts down to get as close to first principles as possible. It is deliberately stripped down. In this series, I want to show how these principles apply to existing stories. Basically, the story ritual is a kind of toolkit for engineering story. I want to show how this toolkit can be used by vivisecting a living, breathing work of art. It's kind of like buying a classic car to dismantle it and see how the engine works. Consider these episodes as a companion piece to the story ritual.
All creative work is mystical. How dare they demystify it? How dare they think they can demystify it? I was never conscious of my screenplays having any acts. I didn't know what a character arc was. John Milius, original screenwriter of Apocalypse Now.
Why would I choose a film that analyzes character arcs that was written by a screenwriter who so passionately discourages them? Three reasons. First, he wrote the original script that became a work of art worthy of serious consideration and analysis, something we can all learn from. Second, the fact that he is unconscious of his own structure exposes just how potent these elements are. And third, perhaps the most important reason, this quote highlights the fact that art is much closer to mysticism than it is a trade. I like that Milius writes from the gut. Writing is a mystical process. All of life is. The fact that we are bottom feeders on the floor of a vast sea of sky churning beneath an infinite canopy of stars that burn ancient flames at scales so far beyond our comprehension, they tempt us to madness. That is mystical. Mysticism is perhaps the humblest way to characterize it. Mysticism calls upon powers of influence for which we have next to no understanding. It doesn't mean magic, as in it breaks the laws of physics. Mysticism is reaching beyond the veil of the known and engaging ancient processes that powerfully affect us. The term mysticism originates from the Greek word maio, meaning to close or to conceal, and its derivative, mystikos, meaning an initiate. In the Hellenistic world, mystikos referred to those initiated into secret religious rituals. The related noun, mysterion, meaning anything hidden or mystery, also contributes to the term's meaning. Essentially, mysticism in its etymological roots is associated with hidden knowledge and the process of initiation into something secret or profound. It is exactly this mysticism we'll try to tap into in our series. I've worked my entire career as a painter, a concept and story artist, as well as a writer and filmmaker. I've dedicated my life to studying great artists through the centuries. It does not demystify the works of Caravaggio or Michelangelo when I deconstruct the anatomy of the poses, the dynamics of the composition, the painting techniques. Instead, it celebrates their genius. The closer you get to the mystical, the more you appreciate its power. To appreciate art, to become a practitioner of art, is to be initiated into the mystical process of creativity. Art is primarily a product of the unconscious. It's an adaptation that invokes ancient mechanisms that conjure dreams. We don't have to teach our unconscious how to dream. It already knows. If anything, we're tracking shadow puppets on a wall. We're all just infants watching simple shapes move across a field and casting our moral judgments on them. To write, to compose a story, to make art, is to dream. We're allowing the unconscious to guide us on that journey. To take up the torch of a storyteller, of artist, we begin by approaching the mystical, the world of the unconscious, the world of dreams. The goal of this series is to shed light on the tools great storytellers use while leaving the mystical intact. In this episode, we'll be deconstructing Apocalypse Now to track the protagonist's character arc. This is an endeavor to dig up the psychological mechanisms that are active in this piece of art to gain further appreciation for what it offers. Apocalypse Now is an ambitious, surreal odyssey into the culture and mythology of war itself. While it uses America's war in Vietnam as a setting, it attempts to approach the very concept of war in some definitive timeless allegory. It began as a script written by John Milius, which was adapted, rewritten, and brought to the screen by Francis Ford Coppola.
You know, really, so often people ask me, who had the idea of the helicopter battle? Who wrote those great lines? I love the smell of napalm in the morning. And I said, that's all John Milius. I wasn't involved in the original creation of the script Apocalypse Now. It was like totally you and then later George Lucas.
It's the product of a bold, aggressive, challenging collaboration between brilliant artists with markedly distinct backgrounds, tastes, and values. Where John Milius is a macho, balls-to-the-wall writer from the gut, Coppola is an artist with classical theater training.
It's a choice of, am I going into an industry or am I going to be an artist?
Coppola graduated from Hofstra University with a bachelor in dramatic arts, where he was trained in live theater stagecraft before becoming a film director.
My experience as a theater student was a big help to me in film school.
He later received his master's in fine arts in 1967 from UCLA. Milius was a young contrarian who worked for Coppola as an assistant on his movie, The Rain People.
There's something about his personality that is sort of oppositional. If the counterculture was going left, he was going to go right to be the opposite of the counterculture.
I really didn't think I would ever have a career in the cinema. I really thought I would have a military career that would probably end shortly.
Coppola, George Lucas, and Milius all collaborated on projects as peers.
It was George's idea to do a movie set in Vietnam because the word was coming back. Vietnam was like a war unlike any war that had come before. And the stories from the soldiers who came back was extraordinary. And so George got a friend, John Milius, who had a lot of buddies who were in the war, and together they cooked up the project.
Apocalypse Now began as a brash, grimdark, slaughterhouse horror spectacle of war loaded to the teeth with irony under Milius's hand.
And of course, the other film that everybody loved then was Doctor Strangelove.
Yeah.
And Doctor Strangelove obviously has a profound influence on Apocalypse Now.
Then, with Coppola's sensibilities and direction, evolved to become a mythical odyssey, layered with allegory and ambitious themes.
It's very hard to talk about these things without being very corny. You use a word like self-purgation or epiphany, they think you're either a religious weirdo or an asshole college professor. But those are the words for the process, this transmutation, this renaissance, this rebirth.
It's like a butcher and a gourmet chef collaborating to make a meal. That's what I love about it. Milius and Coppola are two very different archetypes of artists, and the DNA of both of them lives and breathes in Apocalypse Now. It's one of my favorite films that delves deep into the psyche and doesn't shy from big themes at an epic scale. So, go watch the movie. Even if you've seen it before, go watch it again so it's fresh. It also couldn't hurt to download the script as a PDF and read it. There are several versions available online for free, and each one reveals so much about Milius and Coppola's development process. I've posted links to download both the 1975 script and the Redux, which includes the narration written by Michael Hare, at cinematicore.com. Let's dive in. Apocalypse Now, 1979, directed by Francis Ford Coppola. written by John Milius and Francis Ford Coppola, with Michael Hare writing the narration. Joseph Conrad gets an uncredited attribution for his novel, Heart of Darkness. For years, film buffs, historians, and critics had said it was Coppola's idea to adapt Conrad's novel. However, in an interview with Milius, Coppola set the record straight. He explained that it was initially Milius who came up with the idea of adapting Heart of Darkness into a film, and later George Lucas joined him in developing the script. Though Coppola heavily influenced the development, it was largely Milius who invented the plot, characters, and a lot of the set pieces that have now become so iconic in film history. Milius said that it was his film school screenwriting instructor, Irwin Blacker, who first planted the seed about adapting Heart of Darkness to film. Blacker said it couldn't be done. Milius took that as a challenge.
Heart of Darkness has been attempted many times, and it beat Orson Welles. He couldn't do it. Various other people had tried it, and they'd failed. And Heart of Darkness was one of the great stories of all English literature, and it's stumped every great writer, all these great writers, you know. That was like waving a red flag in front of a young bull.
Milius had become curious about his friend's experiences in Vietnam and began collecting stories.
I had a number of friends who just got back from Vietnam, and they talked about it and everything, and I talked to them a great deal, and I realized I had numerous people, a great deal of information I could get, and I started going and finding anyone I could who'd been in Vietnam.
Any surfers?
Oh, yeah.
It was George Lucas who suggested he write a script based on all the stories he was gathering.
I would just sort of collect everything I could, you know, that
stories.
And so finally, I don't know whether, maybe it was George that said, you should really start writing this thing. You should write this thing.
In Milius's words.
And so when it came time to do it, I thought of Heart of Darkness, and I said, that's what I should do. I should do Heart of Darkness in Vietnam. You know, I should use Heart of Darkness like an allegory.
He'd read the novel when he was 17, and it had a profound effect on him. In his words,
and I thought, well, I should go back and read it. And I said, no, I don't want to read it again, because I remember it as if it were a dream. And I want to read it, I want to have it always be that kind of dream. If I go back and I see it too exactly, I probably will screw it up.
I loved hearing that little detail, especially when it comes to allegory. Some writers who become preoccupied with weaving allegories into their stories turn them into stilted retelling of the events dressed in different costume. It makes the English majors in the audience feel validated, but it comes at the expense of allowing the source material to work its magic through the artist. Pure allegories turn into intellectual exercises. It often draws the audience into deciphering symbolism rather than immersing them in the dream experience of the story. Allegories, like archetypes, are most effective, have the most resonance when they are in disguise, smuggled in, and effortlessly woven into the story. This allows the audience to ruminate over the story and make their own connections. It turns the epiphanies into little truth bombs of insight that blossom in the mind. When the allegory is too close to the surface, we stop engaging the emotional dimensions of the story. We check out. This is important because it informs our effort to identify the themes and the character arc. Milius was not slavishly rehearsing the narrative arc and the conflicts of Heart of Darkness. Instead, he tapped into his fascination with war and the duality of man. He let Heart of Darkness serve as a springboard into his own dream. In this series, we are doing a very specific kind of analysis. It's kind of a literary vivisection. The exercise of vivisecting a living piece of art is the procedure of identifying the anatomy of the plot, digging up the layers of metaphors below the surface, and excavating the moral imperatives that lead us to the themes and thesis of the story. The character arc is the emotional journey that guides us through this procedure. The character arc is the vehicle that carries us from plot to theme. So let's make our first incision into the story and start pulling out the entrails. This is the process of dissecting the events of the story, tracking the plot and turning points to see how they expose the character. This is where we attempt to reconstruct the scaffolding of exegesis for dramatic structure.
The Story Iceberg, Exegesis.
In my book, The Story Ritual, I presented The Story Iceberg. For a more complete breakdown in The Story Iceberg, refer to The Story Ritual available at cinematicore.com. Yes, I'm going to be plugging this thing the whole way through. Daddy's got bills to pay. In essence, the story iceberg is a metaphor to illustrate the layers of a story. It is divided into four layers:
plot, allegory, moral imperative, and theme.
As we vivisect the story, we start with the surface level, then work our way beneath the strata to excavate the meaning buried below. We analyze the plot to identify the metaphors in the allegory, which exposes the moral imperative, which yields the theme. The through line that binds all these elements together is the character arc. The character arc is the inner conflict that presents the theme. Layer 1 is the top layer, the only layer above the surface. This is the plot, the moving parts of the story that we see. Plot is the external actions the protagonist takes to achieve their goal. We track their tactics and strategies to solve problems. It's the emotional roller coaster we experience as they face conflicts and take risks. This is the body of the story. Plot is organized into a dramatic structure. When we watch a movie or read a novel, in essence, we're just watching a series of events, one scene after another. The way they are pieced together, their pacing, their emotional impact determine whether we're engaged in the story. This is where dramatic structure comes in. These are the plot devices that help us organize and present these events in an emotionally compelling way. I provided a full diagram of the dramatic structure of Apocalypse Now Redux at cinematicore.com/Apocalypse Now Decoded. If we look at Apocalypse Now as just a series of scenes, it looks like a linear sequence of events that follow in a logical order, cause and effect. But the art of dramatic structure is identifying the emotional turns the characters experience as they go through these events. These emotional turns form a framework for all the events to immerse us in the story. Dramatic structure is the use of characters acting in conflict to achieve their goals. We use plot devices to identify how these events carry distinct emotional impacts and affect the tactics and strategies the characters use. Here are the essential plot devices that will tell us which events form the framework of the dramatic structure.
Protagonist, dramatic question, plot conflict, and act breaks.
We'll identify these elements of conflict in each scene to be able to identify the character arc. This structure is what gives a sense of emotional purpose to the story. Here are the primary plot devices for Apocalypse Now.
Number 1, protagonist, Captain Willard.
This is his journey, and all of the emotional turns we experience drive us deeper into his psyche.
Number 2, dramatic question,
will Willard assassinate Kurtz?
Number 3, plot conflict,
Willard takes a river patrol boat up the Nung River through an odyssey of perilous waters to Kurtz's outpost in Cambodia to assassinate him.
Number 4, act breaks.
Each act break forces Willard to reevaluate his reasons for accepting the mission, which changes his strategy with a riverboat crew. We'll go into each tactic and strategy as we vivisect the story. So Apocalypse Now is about a deeply conflicted Mac Vsog operative named Captain Willard, who is sent by Field Force to terminate Kurtz's command with extreme prejudice. Just knowing this is the object of desire, we'll be able to organize the primary plot points. We can see how Milius and Coppola, and for that matter, editors Lisa Fruchtman, Gerald B. Greenberg, and Walter Murch, structured the film to set up the plot and resolve it. Now that we have an overview of the story events, we begin to work from the outside in, from the external to the internal, layer by layer. We work like a detective, piecing together all the events and mining for intention. From this, we begin inferring the internal values that produce the behaviors we see on screen, or in the case of a novel, on the page. Every ritual is curated to the individual. Throughout history, most rituals were performed by close members of the tribe, often parents and spiritual leaders. These are people who have a deep investment in the well-being of the initiate, peers, mentors, teachers, instructors, but more importantly, members of their tribe. Their own fates are tied to the fates of those undergoing the initiation. The guides have a deep personal investment in the well-being of the initiate. They would prepare and guide the initiate through rituals that were specific to the lessons and values they needed to incorporate. This is true for story structure and character arcs as well. Each conflict needs to be curated to fit the specific needs of the protagonist. If you only take away one principle from this series, I hope it's this. The conflicts faced by the protagonist must directly affect their Achilles heel. As I cover in the story ritual, the Achilles heel, in essence, is a flawed belief nested within the protagonist's unconscious. It's a limiting belief that sabotages their progress. Basically, the story ritual is the process of transformation that occurs when the Achilles heel, the flawed belief, conflicts with the moral imperative, when our internal drives have to change to adapt to the external world. This is the engine of the character arc. So the conflicts in the story need to be curated to the Achilles heel of the protagonist. This is why I place so much emphasis on first identifying the plot points, the external conflicts, then evaluating how each conflict impacts the protagonist, the character dimensions. The way they navigate these obstacles reveals their internal beliefs. This is not intended to suggest this is how Milius or Coppola organized the script. As I mentioned in the introduction, Milius did not consciously construct acts, plot points, or sequences. I'm not trying to reconstruct their creative method. Instead, we're analyzing the work to see what we can learn from their choices. This is not an attempt to read Coppola's mind or impose a correct interpretation. Instead, we are reverse engineering the machine by taking it apart. Labeling the parts is my way to keep track of them. The use of sequences is a technique I learned from Paul Joseph Gallino's book, The Sequence Approach, which was a compendium of the dramatic theory taught by screenwriter, film director, and teacher Frank Daniel. The principle of the plot points is something I learned from screenwriting mentor Ron Mita. Here are the plot points in Act 1. Plot point 1, Saigon Solitary, and plot point 2, The Commission.
Plot point 1, Saigon Solitary. Object of desire, receive a mission. Obstacle, ambivalence and inner demons conspire to drive Willard to suicide. Tactic, Willard drinks himself into oblivion to numb the torment he feels from having to be without a purpose. Self-deception. Willard manages to stay alive long enough for the army men to retrieve him.
The first act is where we're introduced to the protagonist, learn the rules of the status quo, and get our first indications of their unconscious drive. We also get the impetus, the presentation of the overarching problem they'll set out to solve, the threat or opportunity that'll force them to depart from their status quo. The script, Apocalypse Now Redux, opens with this loaded description.
Coconut trees being viewed through the veil of time or a dream.
It goes on to describe an apocalyptic scene that transitions from the surreal mythical jungle of the sacred to a claustrophobic domesticated hotel room drowning in the mundane. From the script.
Then a phantom helicopter in full view floats by the trees, suddenly without warning. The jungle bursts into a bright red-orange globe of napalm flame. The view moves across the burning trees as the smoke, ghostly helicopters come and go. Dissolve to Interior Saigon Hotel, Day. A close shot, upside down, of the stubble-covered face of a young man, his eyes open. This is B.L. Willard. Intense and dissipated, the camera moves around to a side view as he continues to look up at a rotating fan on the ceiling.
It goes on to describe Willard's ambivalence.
Willard, when I was here, I wanted to be there. When I was there, all I could think of was getting back into the jungle.
We are immersed in a drunken collage of flashbacks cross-dissolving over shots that resemble a prisoner in a cell. One really interesting detail is an insert shot of Willard from the end of the movie, painted in camouflage emerging from the shadows. Willard is a man torn between two worlds. The world of the pretense of civilization and the world baptized in the horrors of war. That's what's so brilliant about the imagery of the ceiling fan mimicking the blades of a helicopter. The room is both a cell and a vehicle. Willard is a prisoner of his traumas, trapped in a vortex transporting him between the past, present, and future. He doesn't know when or where he is. He is deeply unresolved, drowning in disgruntled cynicism and still clinging to the sense of purpose he finds in a mission. He's indulging in a solitary confinement of savagery and paranoia, severing all ties but still clinging to some reason to validate his state. A ghost in this world, haunting the next. This gives us his opening status quo.
Torn between worlds.
This is a state of ambivalence, the state of having mixed feelings or contradictory ideas about something or someone. Ambi and valentia, which means to or on two sides, and strength or power, respectively, having two values in conflict with each other. What are these two values for Willard? The desperation of a purpose in war weighed against the deep hypocrisy of the deception his superiors require to justify the war. This gives us an insight into Willard's unconscious drive. When we look at the story from the perspective of rites of passage, ambivalence often plays a large role. Most rites of passage are rituals performed to assist the initiate from one phase of life to a new one. It requires different responsibilities, new relationships. It's a way of training the initiate to contribute to the community as well as feel valued as an essential member of the group. For example, when a boy reaches the age of puberty, his body and hormones will change his priorities. Where just a few months before he'll want to run around and play hide and seek with boys and girls, now he starts to feel bored of these games. He becomes curious about his body and others in a new way. He's unresolved with his current status and role and grows anxious to seek out new ones. These are indicators that the boy is ready to seek out new trials and conflicts of his own volition, new responsibilities. The first separation phase makes symbolic reference to loss, to leaving the previous state, or the way anthropologist Arno von Genup says it.
The first separation phase makes symbolic reference to loss, to leaving the previous state, or loss of a position achieved in life.
In the case of Willard, he is ambivalent about his role as captain, as an assassin for the state, an errand boy for the army. He is desperate for a mission to give him purpose, to distract him from the budding agitations of his conscience. He hungers for the certainty he found in the successfully accomplishing a mission. But something in his unconscious is telling him that it's time for him to evolve. This is that poison pill that will unravel his Achilles heel. Willard is seeking a new mentor. We have a sense that the man we'll be following on this odyssey is a deeply divided person. But that doesn't quite indicate the Achilles heel. In the next scene, we begin to get a peek into the actual internal model that is driving Willard.
Plot point 2. The commission. Object of desire.
Prove he is worthy of the mission.
Obstacle.
The colonel and general challenge him with a series of questions and disclosures to determine if Willard has the appropriate disposition to complete the mission.
Tactic.
Willard protects the secrets from his previous missions and demonstrates that he understands how much of a sensitive mission this is, that it must also be kept secret.
Result?
Willard accepts the mission. When he's summoned to the Field Force headquarters in Nha Trang, we see the mask he has to wear to navigate these waters. The headquarters is a trailer. The script describes it like this.
Interior trailer day. Cool and comfortable. Furnished like home.
Like home. This is the agonizing theme that haunts every corner of this film, this effort to maintain the facade of home. This is establishing a pattern, all the effort to make a war zone look like the middle of an American suburb, like California dropped into the middle of Vietnam. This scene is where we really begin to dial into Willard's Achilles heel. Willard is introduced to a colonel, a general, and an ominous glaring man in a white shirt and tie, called the civilian. The colonel asks Willard a series of questions that turn out to be a kind of informal interrogation. This is his first trial.
Colonel, your report specifies intelligence, counterintelligence with ComSec, I-Corps. Willard, I'm not presently disposed to discuss those operations, sir. There's a pause as the colonel lights his cigarette, then moves to the sofa. He bends down and picks up a dossier, looks at it. Colonel, did you not work for the CIA and I-Corps? Willard, pause. No, sir. Colonel, did you not assassinate a government tax collector? Quang Tri Province, June 18, 1968? Willard doesn't answer. Colonel. Captain? Willard. Sir, I am unaware of any such activity or operation, nor would I be disposed to discuss an operation, if it did in fact exist, sir. A pause. Willard is tired and confused and hungover, but he is handling himself well.
There's no effort on Willard's part to be convincing. It's a rote response as if reading it from a manual. They all know the answer to the questions, and they all know he won't answer. He is programmed not to. And strangely, the interrogators seem to respect this about him. This is a game of masks, facades, of moral pretense. They expect him to keep his secrets, just like the secrets they're about to share with him. Once he passes this test, he's found worthy. They move onto the mission, Kurtz. This moment reveals as much about Willard as it does about Kurtz, and for that matter, the general, civilian, and colonel. When they listen to Kurtz's recording, they're all haunted. He terrifies them. He's not an enemy. He's something much worse. He's a walking confession of who these men really are, what they've turned all these young men into. Kurtz is Frankenstein's monster, the savage golem these generals have unleashed on this country. Kurtz is a savage mirror, a metaphor for the identity crisis thrust upon the generation of young men who are given no choice but to throw their bodies at bullets in the name of protecting democracy. Here is the impetus.
The presentation of the threat or opportunity.
This defines Willard's conscious desire.
Colonel, your mission is to proceed up the Nung River in a Navy patrol boat. Pick up Colonel Kurtz's path at Nung Mung Ba, follow it, learn what you can along the way. When you find the colonel, infiltrate his team by whatever means available and terminate the colonel's command. Willard, terminate the colonel? General, he's out there operating without any decent restraint. Totally beyond the pale of any acceptable human conduct, and he's still in the field commanding troops. Civilian, terminate. With extreme prejudice. The civilian hands Willard a cigarette and lights it for him. Colonel, You understand, Captain, that this mission does not exist, nor will it ever exist.
Decent restraint. Remember that phrase as we peel apart the layers of this film. These warriors want to carry on a campaign of industrial slaughter across a foreign country, and they pretend to operate with decent restraint. Can you smell the moral contradiction rotting underneath that mattress? The film was set in 1969, 10 years before the movie was released. By 1969, America had lost its stomach for the Vietnam War. The anti-war movement had spread across the entire culture. This was an unpopular war, and the Department of Defense and the Nixon administration were struggling to maintain support for it domestically. There was an ongoing campaign to sell this as a noble effort against the spread of communism. But young men were returning from the war transformed, unrecognizable, and far too many injured, missing, or dead. Someone like Kurtz, this ravenous demigod stalking through the jungles like a rogue savage, was everything the Johnson and Nixon administration were trying to avoid. They needed Kurtz to disappear, to be terminated, with extreme prejudice. This scene exposes Willard's Achilles heel.
Deception about the brutality of war maintains the structural integrity of civilization.
This is the sacred belief that Willard holds buried deep within his unconscious. This belief is what will be challenged and have its reckoning through the ordeals in the story. This is the primary motivator for the impetus. The army needs Willard to kill Kurtz and cover his tracks to carry on the delusion of civilization. They depend on it to rationalize their brutality. Notice the way the mission is phrased. Terminate his command. That's not enough to assassinate Kurtz. They want Willard to sever his command, his reach, his influence. Don't just kill him. Terminate his story.
These guys were all CIA assets from the Bay of Pigs earlier. Never use the word kill. They say neutralize, terminate with extreme prejudice, incapacitate. They don't talk about killing. He thought the intent was to kill me.
Now that we have the impetus, we know what the story is about. The plot is a journey to assassinate a rogue colonel. This is where we return to the story iceberg. We begin with a plot to uncover the allegory. When developing a story, especially when you're pitching and selling your story, you'll often be asked, why this story now? This is what I call the zeitgeist question. What they're asking is, why should people care? Or more specifically, will there be an audience? Allegories are composed of layered metaphors that speak to the audience. Our job is to smuggle these metaphors so they resonate in the unconscious. The truth is, the moment the artist exposes the allegory, they are risking sabotaging their story. But as a story artist, we want to understand the way allegories work in the unconscious to appreciate the role they play in the story. To unravel the allegory embedded in Apocalypse Now, we need to talk about the context in which this film was written and directed.
Context of the story.
In 1971, the New York Times published a series of articles revealing excerpts from the Pentagon Papers. This was a classified study commissioned by the Secretary of Defense McNamara into the status of the Vietnam War.
Hello.
General Haig, sir.
Nothing else of interest in the world?
Yes, sir. Very significant, this goddamn New York Times expose of the most highly classified documents of the war.
Oh, that. I see. I didn't read the story, but you mean that was leaked out of the Pentagon?
Sir, the whole study that was done for McNamara and then carried on after McNamara left by Clifford and the Peaceniks over there. This is a devastating security breach of the greatest magnitude of anything I've seen.
Well, what's being done about it then? I mean, I didn't... did we know this was coming out?
No, we did not, sir.
Daniel Ellsberg, one of the authors of the Pentagon paper, leaked 47 volumes, 7,000-page Defense Department study of the U.S. role in Indochina. The study exposed many of the deceptions and cover-ups the American government told its people to lure America into a war with Vietnam and sustain it for nearly a decade.
But it's something that it's a mixed bag. It's a tough attack on Kennedy. It shows that the genesis of the war really occurred during the 61
period. Yeah, that's Clifford. I see.
And it's brutal on President Johnson. They're going to end up in a massive gut fight in the Democratic Party on this thing.
Are they?
There's some very...
But also massive against the war.
Against the war.
But it's a Pentagon study, huh?
The Pentagon Papers essentially exposed that the government had deceived the American people about the events and objectives in the Vietnam War. The impetus for the American involvement in the Vietnam War was the Gulf of Tonkin incident. In August 1964, a series of confrontations occurred between U.S. and North Vietnamese naval forces in the Gulf of Tonkin.
On August 2nd, the destroyer Maddox reported it was attacked by a North Vietnamese patrol boat. It was an act of aggression against us. We were in international waters. I sent officials from the Defense Department out, and we recovered pieces of North Vietnamese shells that were clearly identified as North Vietnamese shells from the deck of the Maddox. So there was no question in my mind that it had occurred. 2 days later, the Maddox and the Turner Joy, two destroyers, reported they were attacked.
Where are these torpedoes coming from? Well, we don't know. Presumably from these unidentified craft.
There were sonar soundings, torpedoes had been detected, other indications of attack from patrol boats. We spent about 10 hours that day trying to find out what in the hell had happened. At one point, the commander of the ship said, "We're not certain of the attack." Another point, they said, "Yes, we're absolutely positive." And then finally, late in the day, Admiral Sharp said, "Yes, we're certain it happened." So I reported this to Johnson, and as a result, there were bombing attacks on targets in North Vietnam.
This series of events were used as a pretext to drag America into the conflict.
According to the public announcements of President Lyndon Johnson and Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, twice in 2 days the North Vietnamese had attacked U.S. warships on routine patrol in international waters and engaged in a deliberate pattern of naked aggression. Evidence of both attacks was unequivocal, and these had been unprovoked. Reference thezindproject.org.
This incident was used to draft the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which opened up the gates for America to deploy troops and escalate military engagement.
Johnson said, "We may have to escalate. I'm not going to do it without congressional authority." And he put forward a resolution, the language of which gave complete authority to the president to take the nation to war. The Tonkin Gulf Resolution.
The Pentagon Papers revealed that the United States had expanded its war with the bombing of Cambodia and Laos, coastal raids on North Vietnam, and Marine Corps attacks, none of which had been reported to the American people. The DOD, Department of Defense, was expanding its campaign of violence by deceiving the people it was responsible for protecting. This fact is central to the plot and circumstances of the fictional character of Colonel Kurtz. He represents the rogue actions of the American government in engaging in a brutal, costly war. The pretext of the war was to assist Vietnam in defending itself against the spread of communism across Indochina. From 1964 to 1973, approximately 2.2 million men were drafted to serve in the Vietnam War. Approximately 58,220 American soldiers died in this campaign. 303,000 Americans were wounded. Amputations and crippling wounds were 300% higher than in World War II. As of October 2022, approximately 1,582 Americans remain unaccounted for from the Vietnam War.
According to the U.S. Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency, in 1995, Vietnam released its official estimate of war dead. As many as 2 million civilians on both sides and some 1.1 million North Vietnamese and Viet Cong fighters. The U.S. military has estimated that between 200,000 and 250,000 South Vietnamese soldiers died in the war, according to Britannica.com.
Professor Noam Chomsky said this about the Pentagon Papers.
Professor Chomsky, why did Daniel Ellsberg do what he did?
Dan Ellsberg released to the American people information, historical information, about how a series of presidents enmeshed them in a vicious and costly war of aggression. He had every reason to believe that this war was continuing and would continue at the present incredible level of violence. And he hoped, I hope correctly, that if this historical information were brought to the American people, they would do something about it and stop that war.
May he, in fact, have had a duty to disclose the information?
I think he definitely had a duty, perhaps not a legal duty, but certainly a moral duty, to bring to the public evidence about criminal acts. And that's, in effect, what the Pentagon Papers reveal. They are a history of a criminal conspiracy operating in secret to enmesh us in this war of aggression.
Ellsberg was put on trial for leaking classified documents, facing 12 felony counts, a possible sentence of 115 years if found guilty.
After articles about the papers were published, Ellsberg surrendered to the authorities on June 28, 1971.
In Boston, Dr. Daniel Ellsberg, the man named as the source of the Pentagon copy that appeared in the New York Times, turned himself in today to federal authorities.
When the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the newspaper's right to publish the articles, the Nixon administration brought criminal charges against Ellsberg and Rousseau. After a lengthy break in the proceedings, while the Supreme Court considered the implications of the wiretapping of one of the defendants and his lawyer by the government, the trial court judge Matthew Byrne declared a mistrial. Citation, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers, Library of Congress.
After 2 years of fighting these charges in court, it was revealed that President Nixon had taken a series of criminal actions to silence him. According to Ellsberg himself, he claimed Nixon used CIA assets to incapacitate him totally. Thanks to the revelations of the Watergate scandal and the discovery of his own tapes, Nixon was impeached. The Vietnam War ended 9 months later. I believe Apocalypse Now is a thinly veiled allegory of the Pentagon Papers' disclosures and Ellsberg's odyssey into the heart of darkness at the core of the political corruption behind the Vietnam War. Apocalypse Now employed dramatic tropes, allusions, and allegories drawn from Conrad's novel, The Heart of Darkness, as well as the Pentagon Papers and anthropological treatises like The Golden Bough, informed by the emerging volatile political stories pouring through the American psyche of the 1970s. Before Captain Willard enters the trailer, we hear his narration.
Willard, it was no accident that I got to be the caretaker of Colonel Walter E. Kurtz's memory, any more than being back in Saigon was an accident. There was no way to tell his story without telling my own. And if his story is really a confession, then so is mine.
Just listen to that. The caretaker of Kurtz's memory. What a powerful way to frame this story. And notice that phrase, it was no accident. We learned that Kurtz had all but summoned Willard, not only to assassinate him, but to become this caretaker of his story. The monster wants to live through the revelations of his horror. For all intents and purposes, Kurtz needed to mold Willard, change his values to become this. Whether conscious or not, Kurtz was curating a ritual to initiate Willard into his moral sphere. The monologue above is also the first indication we get that the narration isn't an ongoing internal monologue. Instead, this is a recounting of the events. From the perspective of the voiceover, the events we see unfolding on the film are in the past. I believe this is why we see glimpses of Willard from the end of the film. It's all in the rear view. All the narration is from the protagonist after the completion of the character arc, reflecting on his actions from before. That plays a role in the way the story unfolds, and part of the role is casting himself as caretaker. Not killer, not errand boy, not assassin. Caretaker.
I could only regret that I had not at that same time released that information to the American public through the newspapers. I have now done so.
Side note. I won't deny my suspicion that this metaphor plays a large role in a Kubrick film, The Shining. 1980, released the year following Apocalypse Now, the story of a possessed caretaker consumed by the madness of a sinister company that haunts his hotel and drives him to commit acts of horror.
Mr. Grady, you were the caretaker here.
I'm sorry to differ with you, sir. But you... are the caretaker. You've always been the caretaker. I should know, sir. I've always been here.
Stick that in a pipe and smoke it for a few minutes.
Apocalypse Now is the story of Willard recounting his journey, his transformation from assassin to caretaker, to the metaphorical son of Colonel Kurtz. The orphaned and estranged new generation of Americans left in the wake of the madness of the Vietnam War, still grappling with the corrupt forces that conjured it.
Achilles' heel and moral imperative.
A character arc tracks the course of the Achilles' heel as it traverses the moral imperative. In other words, a character arc tracks the transformation in beliefs and values a character experiences as the conflicts drive them to reckon with their beliefs. To properly set up the central dynamic of the character arc, we need to draw a relationship between these two dynamics, the Achilles heel, the internal, and the moral imperative, the external. The moral imperative is the guiding principle of the field of antagonism, called the moral sphere. It dictates the rules of survival within the sphere. The thresholds marking the borders of a moral sphere are forces of antagonism that present themselves as obstacles. These are the threshold guardians, Arno von Genup mentions in his book Rites of Passage, 1909.
Winged dragons, the Sphinx, and all sorts of monsters.
Typically, these obstacles increase in antagonism the closer the protagonist draws to the object of desire. This is what we call the raising of the stakes. In the case of Willard, we've identified his Achilles heel, the limiting belief that sabotages him as he pursues his object of desire.
The Achilles heel, deception about our own brutality, maintains the structural integrity of civilization.
The main question we always have to ask about conflict is this. How does this conflict affect the Achilles heel, that central unconscious belief? All of the forces of antagonism are designed to drive the protagonist to reckon with the moral imperative. Once we've identified it, each conflict needs to be evaluated by how it causes the Achilles heel to be resolved. We get our biggest clue to what the moral imperative is from the commission scene.
General. Well, you see, Willard, in this war, things get confused out there. Power, ideals, the old morality, and practical military necessity. But out there with these natives, it must be a temptation to be God, because the irrational and the irrational between good and evil, and good does not always triumph. Sometimes the dark side overcomes what Lincoln called the better angels of our nature. Every man has got a breaking point. You have, and I have them. Walter Kurtz has reached his. And very obviously, he's gone insane.
Kurtz is the moral imperative. This ritual is designed to endow Willard with Kurtz's sacred values. As he goes through his journey, he uncovers the common principle that guides every conflict, every force of antagonism. In the final scenes, when Kurtz finally discloses what he wants from Willard, why he brought him to this encampment, he tells him what is most sacred to him.
Kurtz. I worry that my son might not understand what I've tried to be. And if I were to be killed, Willard, I would want someone to go to my home and tell my son everything. Everything I did. Everything you saw. Because there's nothing I detest more than the stench of lies. And if you understand me, Willard, you'll do this for me.
After all Kurtz's reveries and platitudes, this is the issue that most concerns him. He needs someone to be the caretaker of his sacred value to pass it on to his son. His great epiphany. This grim insight into humanity is his inheritance. This is the moral imperative.
Moral imperative. To assassinate Kurtz, Willard must become the caretaker of Kurtz's story.
Can you see how this is the antithesis of Willard's sacred value, the dialectical opposite of the Achilles heel? To tell the story of Kurtz's brutality is the only way for civilization to overcome this contradiction of civilization. For the American government to overcome the drive to carry on brutal campaigns of war, the American citizens need to be brought face to face with the horror, to reckon with the hypocrisy embedded deep within the systems of power. That is what Kurtz represents, the unapologetic demand to face the monster the American government has unleashed on Vietnam. And from this, we can see the moral sphere is the jungle. Perhaps the best way to describe it is from Willard's narrated commentary when Willard finally understands what Kurtz really wants.
Willard, voiceover. Even the jungle wanted him dead. And that's really who he took his orders from anyway.
If Kurtz is the moral imperative, the jungle is the moral sphere. Let's return to Willard's character dimensions. We have now identified several essential components to begin tracking the character arc.
Conscious desire.
Assassinate Kurtz.
Unconscious drive.
Find purpose in serving missions for the military.
Achilles heel.
Deception about our own brutality maintains the structural integrity of civilization.
Moral imperative.
To assassinate Kurtz, Willard must become the caretaker of Kurtz's story. Notice how these dimensions flesh out the layers of the story iceberg. On the surface, this is the story of an assassin sent to kill a target. As we dig into his value matrix, his belief system, we uncover a deep-seated contradiction. This contradiction is driving him to ambivalence so violent he's barely holding on to sanity. A character arc is the territory of transformation we cross to resolve inner conflicts, inner contradictions. Willard is gradually waking to a deep contradiction in which he has built his entire identity, his sacred and profane values. The one sacred value is, above all, never tell the truth if it threatens the hierarchy. The very survival of civilization depends on sustaining the hierarchy. the system of power that wages these wars. What's perhaps the most revealing, unstated assumption about this entire inner conflict is that even those in the hierarchy of the military and the political regime that controls it knows that the general public would condemn their actions were they to tell the truth. Were they to be transparent about America's interest in Vietnam, the citizens would not only condemn their actions, they'd be judged as war criminals. Their desperation to justify their actions has led them to engage in paternalistic, patronizing narrative of defense of democracy, sweeping the horrors under the rug, as a bug rather than a feature of war. Do you see how identifying these elements yields theme? See how we can begin to apply this to our own lives, our own circumstances? This film immerses us in a world where our own contradictions are excavated and exposed. How much does our civil order depend on deception? How much do we need our authorities to lie to us so we can never have to face the horror they perform in our name? How long can we live with this contradiction? Are we under the same sword of Damocles, the same thread of ambivalence? Should we continue to delude ourselves? How many lies do we tell ourselves just to rationalize our own horrors? The theme is the central moral value the audience takes away from the story, the generalizable value that controls every conflict. Now that we've identified these essential character dimensions, we can begin to track the arc. In the structure of rites of passage, these two scenes give us the preliminal stage, separation. This lays the groundwork for the transition Willard is about to experience. The initiate is invited to the ritual, dressed with commission, and prepared to cross the threshold. We are given a look under the hood of Willard's current values, the drunken ambivalence that tortures his conscience. Then he's literally carried to a washing and anointing to be presented to his mentors, the commissioners of his ritual. He's summoned and called to the Odyssey. All of this in the name of preparing him to cross the threshold into the underworld. The reason why the first stage of the rites of passage is separation is because the initiate is separated from the known world, the world where their values and strategies are familiar. This is a world where they are already competent. In other words, they are lured or driven out of their comfort zone, cast out of their Garden of Eden, the journey into the vast desert. This separation is the introduction of the rite of passage. This gives us all the machinery we need to track the character arc. Now we're equipped to follow Willard through his story ritual. What measures, what tactics and strategies does Willard use to protect his flawed beliefs? What conflicts force him to recognize the contradictions? What choices reveal his sacred values? What ordeals turn his story from a series of events to a rite of passage? All of these questions will be answered as we immerse ourselves in the story ritual. This is Apocalypse Now Decoded. On the next episode, we'll dive into Willard's relationship with the PBR crew and uncover the archetypal nature hidden within these characters. We'll also discuss thresholds as an essential part of ritual and evaluate the way act breaks function as thresholds in dramatic structure. We'll cross into Act 2 and evaluate Willard's ordeals as he enters the waters that lead him to Colonel Kurtz. Thank you for joining me in this journey into the heart of darkness. Please like, share, comment, review, and follow on YouTube, TikTok, Spotify, and Instagram. Sign up to join my email list at cinematicore.com, where you'll get updates on episodes, classes, and live meetups to discuss story. That's cinematicore.com. If you'd like to experience the story ritual for yourself, check out my book, The Story Ritual, Character Arcs and Rites of Passage, an illustrated guide into the unconscious, available in print, digital, and audiobook. Order it at cinematicore.com. Talk to you soon.